Gary K's Almost Daily Rants and Raves.
The Week.
The Women in AV Wavecast.
Green AV.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Joel Rollins, and this is The Week on Rave Radio. Thanks for stopping by. This week, after we cover the news, we'll be talking about the heartache of Heartbleed with Jim Smith of Polycom. For those of you who've been hiding under a rock for the last couple of weeks, Heartbleed is the latest world-ending calamity to befall the networking and AV community. And when I think of world-ending network disasters, I always think of Jim. Sorry, Jim, but we'll be talking to him shortly. Anyway, we'll be doing that in just a few minutes. In the meantime, let me remind you that The Week on Rave Radio is brought to you by Ingram Micro, the world's largest technology distributor, delivering flexible multi-channel supply chain solutions and more. Find out more at ingrammicro.com. The Week is also brought to you by Atlas Sound, who make a big variety of audio product for our needs in the AV industry. More about them can be found at www.atlassound.com. But while you're here on Rave Radio, take a listen to our other podcasts like the Green AV podcast, AV Insider, and Gary K's Almost Daily Rants and Raves. You can find them all at www.ravepubs.com and on iTunes. Here, we're going to try to address the most important items we see in AV news for the week, and we're going to bring you a range of guests for a conversation about subjects important to our industry. And so, without further ado, let's talk about what's going on in the world of AV. Well, NAB 2014 wrapped up earlier, giving attendees plenty to write home about. For example, Cisco and Sony became the first companies to publicly demonstrate the live delivery of full frame rate, 4K 60p content. The live demo streamed live 4K video from New York City to Las Vegas and was on display for NAB show attendees at the Cisco and Sony booths. Live events in New York City were captured with the Sony F55 4K camera and HEVC encoded using Cisco's VideoScape AnyRes with enhanced support for 4K and HEVC. The live stream was transported from New York to Las Vegas through a fiber optic network. The stream was then delivered to the Las Vegas Convention Center, decoded with Cisco set-top boxes with 4K support, and displayed on Sony XBR 4K Ultra HD TVs. I don't know about you folks, but doesn't sound to me like we're going to be doing that next week, but nice to see that they're working on it. Well, is your June travel calendar filling up? Be sure to save space for June's AV Networking World event. AVNW is a free all-day conference put on by Audinate, providing the lowdown on real-world use cases of converged AV and IT networks. AVNW is co-sponsored by the leading pro audio OEMs and will take place June 17th at the Renaissance Las Vegas Hotel. Panel discussions from leading industry design consultants, installation contractors, networking experts, and major professional audio equipment manufacturers will present case studies on deployment of small and large-scale networked AV systems. There will also be a major interoperability networking demonstration. Due to the space limitation, pre-registration is highly recommended. Visit www.audinate.com to register. In other news, NEC Display has announced the availability of a fully integrated compact DCI-compliant digital cinema projector using a laser light source. Designed for screens up to 11 meters, the NEC NC1100L is for use in venues such as cinemas and art houses, as well as public buildings, theaters, and universities. And like most other laser light-based systems, the projector's light source is spec to last at least 20,000 hours. The NC1100L can be deployed as a complete one-stop digital cinema solution using its built-in integrated media server. The result is an all-in-one integrated media block and 2 terabyte storage server for versatile connectivity and enhanced savings. Visit www.nec-display-solutions.com for the details. Well, for those of you who know him, the outspoken Jeremy Burkhart is back. Burkhart will officially launch his new audio company, Origin Acoustics, at CEDIA 2014 in Denver. Word has it that the new company is working on a product portfolio of home theater speakers, architectural speakers, and electronics. Burkhart, as some of you may know, was once employed by Speakercraft, and he left the company in 2012. And it's been a rocky relationship ever since. He sued Nortec over his non-compete contract because he wanted to acquire outdoor speaker company Soundcast. That deal fell through. Burkhart publicly expressed his disappointment with Nortec over its stewardship of speakercraft. Now, Origin Acoustics will be Burkhart's chance to prove he can do audio better. For future developments, keep your eye on www.originacoustics.com. And from my friends at Extron, they're introducing a new program, Extron Qualified Independent Programming, or EQIP, E-Q-I-P. The program is designed to provide additional configuration resources to customers deploying Extron's control solutions. Here's the idea. Extron customers and integrators can employ EQIP companies to augment their staff, execute projects, and provide options to configure more advanced AV systems. EQIP companies have access to a variety of Extron resources, including web-based tools, continuing education, and control system training. The program is similar to those offered by AMX and Crestron for independent programmers. They help customers find fully vetted, qualified programmers who can handle larger systems. As part of the EQIP qualification, Extron says that programmers will become ECP, Extron Control Professional, certified. Check www.extron.com for details. Well, you can find out more about this as news breaks on this and many other stories at www.ravepubs.com. And that's the news. Now for a little talk that I had earlier with Jim Smith.
Anyway, listen, let's talk about Heartbleed, shall we?
Oh, my God. Sure.
Folks, thanks for being with us again. And with me today, as I mentioned at the top of the show, is longtime friend and contributor to the show, Jim Smith of Polycom. Jim, thanks for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me, Joel.
Jim, I have been, our heart has been bleeding all week long. In fact, I don't think I've ever seen more email about one security issue than I have about Heartbleed. Jim, tell us, for the layman, what is Heartbleed?
Ooh, well, Heartbleed is a opportunity for the general press of the world to jump on top of something that appears to be the demise of the entire internet. What it really is an opportunity for a hacker to get in and sequentially access data files inside of a server. As the Heartbeat engine works, that's part of a secure session. So what people have been getting all crazy about is this notion that everything has become insecure in the internet and there's no encryption available, there's no anything available for personal safety. And the reality is, unless you're trying to manage a server or manage a device using a secure socket implementation, which is one of those software things that we'll get into a little bit later maybe, there's no real problem. So, you know, there's a couple of contrary perspectives here. First perspective is the internet is fundamentally insecure and everything is hackable right now. That's not the case. The second perspective is, oh my goodness, all of my endpoints are now subject to compromise and my network is going to be violated. And that's not the case either. So, you know, primarily people's fears should be somewhat allied or like because their fundamental network security is not compromised. It's a device by device problem. It's a management of those device kind of problem. And yes, at some point, somebody could get in through the Heartbeat function and access the data pools inside the network device and gather up information that could compromise later security. But as right now, the problem is way blown out of proportion to what is actually going on.
Okay, let's since you're so good at this, let me ask you about the fundamentals of this. Okay.
Okay.
First of all, this is Heartbleed is due to a flaw in OpenSSL.
Yes, sir.
What is OpenSSL, and are there other SSLs that aren't open?
Okay, OpenSSL is just it's kind of a software implementation of security by committee. It's developed in the open software market. It's public domain software. It's kind of like Linux, where it's a lot of different people working on it, and it's a lot of different contributors, which also means there's a lot of different eyes looking at the result to try to guarantee its safety and security and everything else. What happened here was there was effectively a typo in the heartbeat function of OpenSSL. And what a heartbeat is a periodic signaling that goes on in the network that keeps a connection alive, keeps a connection open. So if you're doing a remote management session to a server, for instance, or a website, in order to keep that connection active all the time, or while there was a browser attached, the system would send out a periodic ping, a heartbeat. And when the other end received that heartbeat, it would respond in kind, and the connection would stay alive. And this is because firewalls have been put in place in all aspects of network capability that effectively shut down connections when they're not used for some period of time. So this heartbeat function is intended to get around the limitations that are imposed by overly aggressive firewalls.
Okay.
So this is a self-perpetuated issue. And the open source community does this OpenSSL, and it's intended to be a verified, unified, inviolable kind of environment where anyone can take advantage of it and use it as we go on. But this heartbeat issue was essentially the result of a typo, and everybody missed it.
I see. And I have to admit that on the surface, I have been, over the last few years, a complete convert from proprietary software to I'm a member of the OSF, and I really like the move towards open software. And a lot of it is because it enables a lot of the devices that I use to talk to each other in the same formats, as opposed to having to have proprietary software and interpreters to make them talk to each other. So is this, though, but what I got as an argument to being for open software, for instance, I'm a big Linux fan, right?
Mm-hmm.
But what I got as an argument to it from my friends, especially my friends in the heavily Microsoft camp, was that proprietary software is by definition, safer software. Is that true?
Proprietary software breaks differently than open domain software. Microsoft themselves broke their own software a few years ago. It's one of those unintended consequences of having multiple people working on the same package. So no matter who you are, where you are, what you've done, there's no fundamental safety guaranteed by one method or the other. In fact, what most people in the open software world will say is that because there's so many different eyes on the software, it's fundamentally more secure, because anybody who has had a hack experience will contribute that to the open source database and try to prevent it from occurring again. In a proprietary software environment, a Microsoft, a Oracle, whatever, they may not have experienced a particular hack kind of environment, and so won't put in protections against it until that viability is seen in the open market. So, you know, a lot of times Microsoft has got a every other week or every 3 weeks or so, they've got a security update that's automatically pushed out to the field. As people discover potential violations in their protocols, Microsoft has to update their software on a regular basis. So that argument is kind of fuzzy, we'll put it that way.
Well, and the other reason that it's fuzzy to me, I mean, ever since I started really working with open software, is that the flaws you get immediate feedback from the field on, I found this flaw. Whereas, you know, having worked closely with Microsoft, with Apple, with a lot of big software companies with proprietary software, they're not going to tell people about it. They're going to go to work on it, but they're not, they don't want the news to get out to the field of it. As a result,
absolutely,
there's always this gap in time where the hacker community seems to know about the flaw, but Apple, Microsoft, Oracle are still working on it and aren't talking about it yet. So I really wonder if just the very instant exposure of flaws in open software doesn't make it safer.
Yeah, it really does. You know, one of the things that happened with Heartbleed is the exposure to the hack was noted a couple months ago. And they gave, the folks who discovered it, gave the open source community time to figure out how to close the gap, how to close the loophole before they publicized that there was, in fact, a problem. And so, you know, things like this are sometimes really good because the manufacturers had a head start. And if you notice, a lot of patches have been issued almost instantly as a result of the exposure of the Heartbleed hack. But in the proprietary software world, it might be a month or 2 months because they've got a scheduled software release coming out. They're already in process to vet that software. And then to put in a patch means they've got to delay that software release. So they're going to do something to try to defray the public awareness of a particular exposure and then get it rolled into the normal software release path. And this is part of the reason why there are regular software updates that are promoted by certain companies that are out there. You know, they have to get these exposures addressed. They have ongoing exposures, and everybody has ongoing exposures. Do you remember about a year or so ago, one of the online reader companies had a hack that went in that was on websites, and what they did is they populated websites with the company didn't, but hackers populated the websites with a pop-up that indicated a new version of the reader was available. Click on this link to install. And when you did that, it put in a piracy software into your computer and created about a 3-second window of opportunity to break the software lock before your computer went belly up. And that was a really annoying thing, and it was an exact duplicate of their normal update window. So, you know, things like this happen all the time, and if people want to get all, you know, crazy about it and say, oh, well, we've got fundamentally insecure environments, and we now have to go with proprietary software or some other means of protection, they're really doing themselves a need for counseling. It's not going to be good.
Well, okay, there's, I guess, a couple of things. Number one that I've been really surprised by is, of course, the talk has largely come from the conferencing manufacturers, yourselves at Polycom, Cisco, and it's been, you know, there's been a whole lot of material forthcoming. But what surprised me about it was it's not just the conferencing manufacturers that have an issue with Heartbleed. It's almost anybody who had web-based sign-ins to a secure environment for a device. Is that correct?
Yes. I think the most recent estimate was something around 70% of the publicly available access ports were subject to OpenSSL Heartbleed violation.
So this would also be web-configurable routers?
Yes.
Devices like that. So devices that actually have a whole lot more exposure of information than my conferencer does.
Oh, yeah. Most of the public internet switches, the Junipers and Ciscos that are the core routers and switches in the internet, almost all use OpenSSL as their access control. So if they're running the 1.0 version of OpenSSL, they have exposure. And, you know, like I said, the most recent estimate was something around 70% of the entire environment had this potential exposure. But where that sits is in the administrative side of things. So if you're trying to set up a secure session between two remote endpoints, you're not subject to this Heartbleed hack. But if you're trying to control the router, if you're trying to control the website, then you've got the Heartbeat indicator public, and now you've got the opportunity to come in and grab extra data during the Heartbeat interval. So, you know, this whole thing is a not an easy hack. You know, it parses out to be, oh yeah, this Heartbeat function is there and everything can get at it, and now you can download anything. You can download anything in 64K blocks. And you have to do this iterative function on a 64K interval in order to get all the information that you might want to get, and then you've got to parse it out later. So this isn't something simple. It isn't something that is going to affect everybody's communication. And most importantly, on an endpoint for video conferencing, it's the administrative side of it. It's the web interface. It's the configuration. It's the setting for your dialing. It's not about getting into your network. So where most people panicked was that they thought, because of the amount of press that this was getting, that this was an open port to get from public outside into their local area network, and the hack was, you know, all your security was gone. But the reality is, no one has ever, ever, ever been able to hack from an administrative port into a local area network via a video conference system, ever. So these are, you know, the reaction was way disproportionate to the threat.
Okay, how exactly would Heartbleed be exploited? I mean, in layman's terms.
Okay, when you get to a system access point, you know, a web browser coming into a system, you get a login, you get a login challenge, and you would have to access that login challenge. And in a lot of cases, and, you know, people will probably gack when they hear this, but in a lot of cases, people just don't change the default passwords when they put together systems out in the field. So you look at a Netgear piece of router equipment, and the default is admin password.
Right.
And people try that first, and oh boy, I can get in.
Or on their major competitor, it's admin public.
You know, so these things don't get changed, and now you've got opportunity to get into the system.
Right.
People have been lax about their security, but still, you have to be able to get into to a secure session somehow anyway. But in the
let me get this straight. In order to exploit this, you have to already be in a secure session.
You have to open a secure socket.
Okay.
You can do that as a guest entity, and get at the data. And this is the real flaw, is that as a guest entity, you can get into the admin environment, and during the Heartbeat function, you can request more data than the Heartbeat provides.
Right. So, I saw a cartoon about this.
Yeah. So when you get this data pool sent to you, you're kicked off the system, and then you come in again, and you get the Heartbeat, and you ask for more data, and you get the next block, and you get kicked off the system. So this isn't the reality is, this is a very cumbersome hack, but people have lots of time, and they'll get in, but they get the administrative functions. They get the administrative information. So in a lot of production environments, people will do things to shortcut. So they'll put in a password, and that same password will be used for multiple devices. It'll be used for multiple
environments. This was what I was about to ask, was if it looked to me like the easiest thing to get with Heartbleed was the last valid entered set of passwords. If those, I mean, that's great.
Yes.
If they could configure my conferencer, you know, okay, oh boy, they could lower my data rate.
Exactly.
But if those same passwords were the ones that that MIS guy had used for instance, routers, then you could actually put yourself on someone's network. You couldn't do it through a conferencer, but you could do it if you used a conferencer to expose a password that had been used for multiple things.
Exactly.
Now,
exactly.
That is something that I would swear, besides myself, most of my clients are guilty of.
It's one of those easy things.
Right.
You know, it's hard to remember a lot of passwords. It's easy to apply one password to multiple domains.
Well, if you have hundreds of devices that you're responsible for, you know, the whole, you know, I maintain a giant notebook in my pocket of individual passwords for thousands of devices that other people have passwords for, that becomes cumbersome.
Yeah, it's like the Post-it environment in my office. You know, I've got all these Post-its on the wall that have different passwords for different environments. And I never know which one's which.
Now, the things I govern from my computer, either via VPN or via HTTPS, mm-hmm. About a year ago, I adopted a great utility called 1Password that basically you unlock the program, but then it unlocks everything else using individual passwords for every device. So I only have to remember 1Password, but it will then create strong passwords for everything and remind me to change them, and in many instances, change them for you.
Now, that's a good solution, and that can prevent people from being their own worst enemy. And really, the Heartbleed exploit is about people being their own worst enemy.
Okay, so one of the pieces of advice I saw was the easiest way to stop Heartbleed from working at all while patches are being issued is to put it behind a firewall that blocks HTTPS.
Yes.
Is that sufficient?
Port 443 is the violation port in most web environments, and that's the secure or the place where you need to add a layer of security. In most cases, that takes care of the issue. If they can't get into the firewall, then there's no possibility of getting at that secure port. Firewalls are intended to prevent unrequested traffic from entering into a network environment. And as soon as you put something inside the firewall, you no longer have exposure. So that's an easy fix.
Right, except for those things which have to be exposed to the outside. I
well,
mean, and what putting that conferencer behind a firewall would do is essentially say you could no longer configure it from outside your network.
Right, right.
Not a big loss, since most people that I deal with are on VPNs to do that with anyway.
Yeah, and in that really, in a best practices kind of environment, they should not have full exposure of their control and management ports to the outside world. So don't do that. You don't have a problem.
Right. Doctor, it hurts when I do this. Well, then don't do that.
Exactly.
Okay. Jim, we're going to run out of time. So what are the best things, best practices currently for avoiding issues with Heartbleed?
Okay. Keeping things inside the firewall. Don't change your password settings until a patch is available. Because as soon as you change your password, it's now the first record that's available to the outside world. And that's going to make it easier to get your new password. So wait until the patch is available, then change passwords.
That's why a good friend at Apple was telling me that the worst days of Heartbleed actually being exploited were the immediate days after it was made public, because everyone immediately went and changed their passwords.
Oh my goodness gracious, did that cause a mess. Yeah, there was an awful lot of secure data traffic running through the public internet that was now in possibility of capture. So again, don't do that. But you know, put one other thing is if you can turn off the SSL access on your systems, do that because now you've got no possible exposure of port 443. So you're done. It no one can get in, and they can't get the data. They can't get anything. If you can't do that, then the inside the firewall is the right thing to do. But one of the things that a lot of manufacturers have done is looked at their need for a heartbeat function. Do we need to keep this port open for extended periods? If not, disable. And the fastest cure for the heartbleed exposure is to turn off the heartbeat function. Once that's done, the problem goes away. There is no issue.
How much of an issue is, I mean, realistically, how long is it going to take for this to be, you know, for all the fixes to percolate through the market? And I know you can't speak for all manufacturers, and you're not speaking officially for Polycom in this session, but as an engineer, what's a guess?
They should be able to address this with a hot fix within 30 days maximum.
And in the meantime, let's pay attention to our firewalls.
Yeah. Best way to protect yourself.
Can you tell if someone's been attempting to exploit this?
There are programs that are in the public domain now that will tell you if you have heartbleed vulnerability. There are network scanners, which for the most part, third parties are not allowed to run. You would have to have your own IT department run the heartbleed scanner, and then it will tell you if you have potential exposure. There's no real way of telling if you've been violated, if you've had somebody come in and steal your information, unless you can trap the logs. You know, you've got some active diagnostic that's running. And for the most part, people don't do that on public access ports. It's just too much data.
Sure, sure. But then again, most of those devices will also generate a log.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so if you're good at log reading, you can go in and see that somebody came in from IP address thus and so, and you know, was denied access. If you see a sequence of denied access, then you probably got a heartbleed instance.
Okay. Well, all right then. For now, we're going to watch our firewalls, we're going to pay attention to our fixes, and we're going to wait for the next one of these end of the world kind of consequences.
There's a comet coming later this year, right? So that's going to be it.
And I'm sure there's going to be some kind of a network vulnerability because of it.
Exactly.
Anyway, Jim, thanks for being with us today, and thanks for the great explanation.
Joel, it's always a pleasure to work with you.
Well, that's all we have time for. But join us again next episode here on The Week on Rave Radio. And don't forget, there's lots more to listen to in our other podcasts on Rave Radio. Check them all out at www.ravepubs.com and on iTunes. And thanks once again to our sponsors, Ingram Micro and Atlas Sound, for helping us bring you this show. Check them out at the links provided on the page where you got this podcast. And thanks for listening to Rave Radio. I'm Joel Rollins, and I'm wishing you a great week ahead.